is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Dan Evans, head men's basketball coach at the University of North Georgia, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
I want all coaches to hear this and know that your efforts, as small as they may seem, you know, they might just seem like they're a drop in the bucket, but at least it's a drop in the bucket. And over time, your efforts, little by little, it makes a little, a lot. And that's the privilege you have every day.
Clint Pulver is the author of the book, I Love It Here. He is also an Emmy Award-winning motivational keynote speaker, author, musician, and workforce expert. Clint helps organizations retain, engage, and inspire their team members. He expertly helps audiences navigate generational complexities, communication challenges, leadership missteps, and cultural cues. Clint strongly believes that a single moment in time can change a person's life. His mantra, it's not about being the best in the world, it's about being the best for the world. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, The Green Light, Courtside Culture, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavaliers Central, Knuck a Few Buck, 305 Culture, Hashtag Lakers, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, Spanning the Spurs, LA Hoops, The Wizards Hoops Analyst, Lakers Fast Break, and At the Buzzer. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Be prepared with a notepad and pen as you listen to this episode with Clint Pulver, author of the book, I Love It Here.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And tonight, we are pleased to be able to welcome the author of the book, I Love It Here, Clint Pulver. Clint, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Dude, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. Jason, means a lot. It's good to be with you guys.
We are excited to be able to have you on. Had an opportunity to read your book prior to having you on the podcast tonight, and there is just a lot of great stuff in there that is applicable to our audience of basketball coaches. So I'm excited to be able to dig into some of the nitty-gritty details and some of the things that you learned in doing your research and how we can apply that to basketball coaches and help them to improve their programs and themselves as a coach. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the why behind the book. Give us an idea of where the inspiration for the book came from, and then why now is the right time to write it, even though you told us prior to the show that you've been working on it for 4 years.
Yeah, for sure, man. So the book started 5 years ago when I was on a trip to New York City, and I was a part of a mastermind group with other CEOs, executives, leaders, coaches, and we were meeting with other successful entrepreneurs, business owners. And one of the guys that we met with owned a sporting goods store in downtown New York City. In Manhattan, beautiful store, sports swag galore. And we were learning from this guy about how he created a business that had adapted through all of the decades, the transitions of business. And he talked about how if you don't adapt, you're going to die. And he said it in that thick New York accent. He said, you got to adapt or you're going to die. It was very profound. I still remember it. And he said, you know, we're on Amazon now. We've got an Instagram. You know, the old brick and mortar style of doing business is dead. If you just, you know, put up a business and advertise in the newspaper, you are not going to survive. And I agreed with him. And then I asked, I said, so what about your management style? You know, you have this need to adapt your business and your strategy, but what about people? Have you changed the way you manage today versus the way you managed 20 years ago? And he fired back and he said, nope, not at all. The way I manage today is the same way I managed 20 years ago, and we get results. And it was another like fairly profound, pretty bold statement. And I thought, okay, it's interesting. He feels the need to change his business to meet the demands of the marketplace, but no need to change how he interacts with humans. And I looked around the store, and all of his employees were my age or younger, like young millennials, Gen Z, younger people. And I thought, I wonder, I'm just curious, I wonder if they would say the same thing. So I thanked the guy for his time. We had 35 minutes to kill until we needed to be to the next place. And I had nothing else better to do, so I walked up to the first employee. Now, mind you, you guys, I looked like a normal customer. I had a backwards hat on, regular. I was just wearing a t-shirt, Nikes, just a customer. And I walked up to the first employee and I just said, hey, I'm just curious. What's it like to work here? And the employee kind of like looked around, got really quiet. I felt like we were doing like an illegal drug exchange. And he said, do you really want to know? And I said, yeah, I'm genuinely curious. He said, dude, I cannot stand it here. I'm like, okay, well, you know, really? And he goes, he said, I don't even think my manager knows I'm here right now. He said, we are literally numbers. We're all cogs in a wheel. It's just a job, man. And I'm like, okay, well, then why are you still working here? And he said, no, I've already applied to 3 other places. As soon as I get an opportunity, I'm out. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe the kids had a bad day. Right, so I go to the next employee, ask the same question, and then the next, and the next, and the next. In that 35 minutes, you guys, I interviewed 6 employees, all asked all the same questions, and at the end of those conversations, 5 out of the 6 said they would not be working for this guy and his store in less than 3.5 months. The perception of the coach, the perception of the CEO, the manager, versus the reality of the employees, the reality of the players was night and day different. Like it could not be more different. And that was the moment for me that I started the Undercover Millennial program. It's kind of like Undercover Boss without the makeup. If anybody's ever seen that TV show, and how it would work is I'd walk into an organization and I would be someone who was looking for a job. Just like I did in that story, the origin story. And the employees would tell me everything because I wasn't a manager. I'm not a survey. I'm not someone in the company. I'm just another millennial. And we have done this for over 5 years now. And we have, through this course and 4 years of writing the book and conducting the research, I've worked with 181 organizations and I have interviewed over 10,000 employees undercover. And through this movement, this endeavor, this journey, I believe we have I believe that we have collected the most real and authentic data behind how great leaders, how great coaches were creating organizations and teams that people, players, and employees never wanted to leave. And the beauty of the book is it's not another leadership book written by a self-proclaimed leadership expert. This is a book that's written by 10,000 employees who knew when their leaders were getting it right. And it's been a beautiful thing to be a part of.
And I think what I took away from the book is it's clearly directed at from a business perspective. And yet, as I was reading it, every single thing that came across in the book not only was reflective of what might happen in business, but the reason why we wanted to have you on is because it's also reflective of what goes on a team and where the leader is the coach. And I think that as I was reading it, on every page almost, I was able to pull out something and say, ooh, I can see how that applies to my time as a basketball coach. I can see how someone who is the leader of a program, whether that be at the college level or the high school level, can take this lesson and learn something from it and apply it to make their program better. So I think what I want to do, and I think this will be a great way for us to organize the podcast tonight, is to just kind of go through some of the lessons that you've learned over the course of those 10,000 interviews. And let's take those general concepts and then we're going to break them down into how they apply to coaching. So what I'd like to do is just read directly from your book each of those different principles, and then I'll give you my take on how I think they apply to coaching, and then you can fill in the details after that, if that makes sense. Perfect. All right, number one, a single moment in time is priceless and can change a person's direction in life. So when I read that, I think about things that coaches have said to me when I was a player that I still remember that had a profound impact on me, not only in my basketball career, but in my life. It's harder to know going the other way unless a player comes back and tells you something that you said to them, because a lot of times things that we say, we don't always remember and we don't realize sometimes the impact that they have, which I think is exactly what this principle is saying. I'm going to give you a quick story. So when I was a high school player, and again, we're talking, this is a long time ago. I'm 51 years old, so we're talking whatever that would be, 26 or so years ago when I was a high school basketball player, and I was being recruited. I was being recruited by a school in Atlanta, Georgia, Oglethorpe University, which was an NAIA school. And I will never forget, an assistant coach while I was on that trip told me that I told him where some of the other schools were that I was considering. And one of them was a school that I ended up attending, which was Kent State, which is a Division I school. And as I said, Oglethorpe was an NAIA school. And this coach said to me, he said, you don't want to go to Kent State because if you go there, they're just going to recruit over top of you next year and you're never going to play. If you come here, you can score 1,000 points and have a great career. And I always thought I was a Division I player. That stuck with me. And all through my 4 years while I was at Kent, I heard that coach's quote in my head all the time. And in my last game of my career as a senior, and I didn't know it was my last game because it was a tournament game that we ended up losing, but nonetheless, it could have been my last game. And I went into that game and I needed to score. Let me think about the math now. So I needed to score 11 points to get to 1,000. I ended up getting 17 and finished my career with 1,006 points. And so there was something that a guy said to me. I'm sure 10 minutes later, he had no recollection that he said it to me, but it impacted me in such a way. And in that case, it ended up being a positive, even though his comment was somewhat negative. It ended up being a positive in my life. But I guess the point here is that one single moment with him maybe changed the direction and gave me some fire, gave me some motivation to be able to do the things that I did. So take it from there. How is a single moment in time priceless in being able to change a person's direction in life?
Yeah, man, it's a beautiful story, Jason, or excuse me, Mike, because here's the thing. Team members, they don't remember days, they remember moments. And we've all had those people in our lives. It's a difference between being a successful coach and a significant coach. There's a big difference there. You have the coach that's always focused on the W's. They're always focused on the win. They're always focused on the performance. They're always focused on the development. But then you have the coaches that are equally focused on advocating, creating moments of connection, moments of inspiration, moments where they communicated your potential and your worth as an individual so well to the point that you saw it within yourself. And I have a similar story. I was a kid I had a hard time sitting still in school. I would tap nervously on a desk. I would just move. And obviously, everybody else in the room, that's annoying because nobody wants to hear that. I got nicknamed the twitcher, the tapper. I got sent to the principal's office. And I was constantly deemed a problem until one day I had a teacher, and his name was Mr. Jensen. And he told me to stay after class, and he said, "Clint, listen, I got to talk to you." And I'm thinking to myself, I'm getting kicked out of school as a 10-year-old. And he pulls me to the side, sits down, and he says, "Listen, I know you're the kid that's on the list. You're the kid that everybody else talks about, like all the teachers. You're the problem child. Everybody nicknames you. You tap in my class, and you tap in everybody else's class." He said, "But I've watched you. And you'll start writing with your right hand, and then you tap with your left hand. And then you can switch the pen, and you'll move your pen over to your left hand, and you start tapping with your right hand." And he looked at me and he said, I think you're ambidextrous." And I'm like, "I'm Presbyterian." And he said, "No, that's not what it means. That's not what this means." He said, "Can you tap your head and rub your belly?" And I said, "Yeah, I can do that." And he said, "Can you switch it?" And I just had this independence over my limbs. And he sat back and he looked at me and he said, "I don't think you're a problem. I just think you're a drummer." And some people hear that and they go, "What's the difference between those two things?" I don't think you're a problem. I just think you're a drummer. But in this moment, you guys, he reached back and he opened up the top drawer and he reached inside and he took out my very first pair of drumsticks. My very first pair. And he put them in my hands and he made me promise. And he said, "Clint, I have no idea what's going to happen, dude, but I want you to just keep them in your hands as much as you can." And that was 22 years ago. And I can sit here today and on this show, honestly tell you that 22 years ago, literally to this exact day, I have tried my best to keep my promise to Mr. Jensen. And for 22 years, I've had the opportunity to tour and record all over the world as a professional drummer. I played with the Blue Man Group, Carrie Underwood, Tim McGraw. I was on America's Got Talent. I remember when I graduated high school, I had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And so what do you do when you're at that point? You go to college, right? So I went to college. I graduated in 2012 with a bachelor's degree and zero college debt, zero. And that was from music scholarships. And I don't say all that to go, you know, like, "Wow, Clint, good for you," or "What a list of accolades." But it's a very similar story, like you talked about, Mike, that it was because of one moment where somebody decided to advocate for you. They sparked a possibility. And in doing so, it changed your life forever. Great coaches know how to design moments where people like themselves best because they're with them. Single moments in time that have the ability to communicate potential and worth so well to the point that those players see it within themselves. That's significant coaching, not just successful coaching.
And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when you look at this particular principle, I think it's something that oftentimes we as coaches don't even necessarily know. I mean, we can intentionally try to create those moments and we can be conscious of the way that we're talking to our players, but we may not know what particular thing we've said that can impact a player tomorrow, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Here's you, here's me carrying those things that someone did for us or said to us, oh, this many years later. And again, I'm guessing that maybe Mr. Jensen remembers your story because it's a little bit more personal. But I'm certain that the guy who was the assistant coach back that long ago has no idea or has no recollection of ever saying that to me. Probably doesn't even remember me at all. And yet I'm carrying that with me. And I think it speaks to the power that we have as coaches to be able to have an impact, positive or negative, on our players. And it leads to me just using a word that I use on the podcast all the time, is being intentional about the language that you use and the way that you speak and the things that you're trying to create for your team, for your players. And when you do it right, you can have that long-lasting impact that goes way beyond that practice, that one game, that season. It's going to be something that that player is going to carry with them for the rest of their life. And I think that's critically, critically important.
And it can be designed, right? Like Mr. Jensen, it wasn't just like a fluke thing where he's like, hey, good job, kid, or like, hey, you should play the drums. No, it was designed. He planned it out. And I think, you know, sometimes we coach by default, right? You get in the habits, you're in the routine. This is what we did last year. I've been a coach for 20 years. I've got my methodology. I know what I need to do. And you do it. But there is, you know, you talked about creating a moment, being intentional about a moment. And I would add to that and say, design it. Like when you go out to coach tomorrow, the next day, and you're with your team, think about it. Like truly design a moment in a player's life. Pull them aside. Sit down and just say, hey, listen, I just want you to know that when I looked at you, when I saw you play today, I saw this. I saw how your feet, you know, the technique and where you were at 2 weeks ago versus where you're at today. Dude, I see it. I see it in you. I just want you to know that. And listen, if you keep doing what you're doing, this is what I see you becoming. That's it, dude. You're communicating potential and you're communicating worth. And as a coach, you just designed a moment that could transform a player's methodology, their ideology, how they think, how they feel, what they're thinking about themselves, and spark the motivation to do better. Create it. Design the moments. It matters.
It does. Agreed. All right. Principle number two. Leadership is a key factor in this case, employee retention. People quit bosses, not jobs, and they stay for them too. So if we replace the word employee with player, leadership is a key factor in player retention. Players quit coaches, not teams, and they stay for them too. And I think when I read this, I think about the coaches who I've played with or the coaching staffs and teams that I've been on, where when we've done a good job of leadership or when the coaches that I played for did a good job of leadership, it made everybody want to be a part of it. And everybody started rowing the boat in the same direction. And in situations where the leadership maybe is not as good, maybe you don't have people necessarily quit the team, although that certainly happens. But a lot of times you can have kind of an inside mutiny where the players are there and they're still playing because they want to play, but it's almost like they're playing in spite of the coach instead of playing together with the coach. And it's almost like they're rowing the boat in opposite directions instead of getting everybody together and moving that ship in the same direction. So how do you think this principle applies to the coaching profession?
In our research, we found that people, the number one reason why they stayed in a job was because of management. Management was also the number one reason why they left. And in every organization, we found four different types of managers. And so for this purpose of the show, we're going to call them the four different types of coaches, because it's universal. Like, I wrote the book, yes, for managers and people in the corporate world, but they are universal truths that apply to coaching. They apply to relationships. They apply to just human connection. And so there's always two variables that we need to address in this when we talk about good management and good coaching. And those two variables are standards, and the second one is connection. Standard is the development. It's how you run the team. It's how you grow your team. It's the expectations. We arrive 5 minutes late as a team. We perform until this time. We hustle this hard. I'm going to grow you. I need us to get from point A to point B to point C. The standards of the team. But then there's the second component, and that is connection. I believe that no significant loyalty on your team will ever happen without significant connection. Why? Because every one of your players is asking you as a coach, let me know when it gets to the part about me. And some coaches hear that and they go, well, those entitled little shining stars in my life, right? Like, let me know when it gets to the part about me. But listen, it is not so much about entitlement as it is about good business, about good coaching, bringing humanity back into the sport. And we look at that and it bothers me because some coaches, they look at that as either the soft skills, the intangibles. Don't tell me I need to coddle my players. But yet they wonder why nobody listens to them. Or they wonder why they can't recruit anybody. Or they wonder why we're not getting engagement, loyalty, buy-in, why things aren't being implemented. Because you haven't gotten to the part about them. And there's lots of ways to do that. But I think in identifying these four different types of coaches, you see some pretty interesting diagnoses, some pretty interesting things that happen because of the decisions that the coach makes. So number one, the first coach is the removed coach. This is a coach that's low on standards and they're low on connection. This is the coach that should have stopped coaching 20 years ago. They're tired. They're burnt out. Like they have no idea who they're playing next week. They're tired. They're in the team, but they're not into the team. They're there, but they're just not. They're removed. And so what does this create in the team? Disengagement. Coach could care less if we show up on time or not. Why should we show up on time? Coach literally has no idea what I do outside of basketball. Like, so why should I care about what he tells me to do and how does that get to the part about me? The second coach is the buddy coach. This is the coach that wants to be liked more than they want to be respected. So they're really high on connection, but they're low on standards. They don't want to ruffle any feathers. They don't want to take anybody off. They don't want a parent coming and jumping down their throat because they harped on a kid. This is where you find on a team where the players become more of the coach than the coach does, because there's a sense of entitlement. You know, this is the coach that goes and plays Xbox on the weekends with the players. Like, they're high on connection. They're a homie. The coach is a homie, not a coach. But the third is the most common, unfortunately. And that is what we call the controller. This is the coach that's high on standards and low on connection. It's like that old command and control model of coaching. This is the coach. It's like, listen, put your head down. You go to work. Be glad you're on this team. Don't complain to me. I don't want to hear it. Listen, I don't care what you did on the weekends. We're here to get a W. We're here to win. Put your head down. Go to work. And what does this create? Rebellion. This is the coach that's, again, high on standards, low on connection. They are constantly trying to go toe-to-toe with every player on the team instead of shoulder-to-shoulder. There's no collaboration. It's my way or the highway. And if you don't like it, get off the team. But the fourth coach, you guys, man, this was, again, I think the difference between success and significance. And it's what I call the mentor coach. They were equally high on their standards as much as they were equally high on their ability to connect. They understood, yes, we have development and growth, and we have, you know, there's an objective. We need to win a game. I want us to perform. But I also understand that you're a person. And every player is an individual. I understand how to empathize. I understand how to be relatable and to have patience and to connect. And what did this create in the players? Respect. They might not have always been liked by the players, but the coaches were respected. And there's a reason, you guys, why I call it mentorship versus management or even a leader or even a coach. Mentorship is different than all of those. For example, leadership is like you're the guy in the front and you're leading the organization. You have the vision, you stand in front, you lead, you get people to follow you. That's leadership. Where's the ship headed? A manager is really good at making sure that the ship has no leaks. How do we get from point A to point B and make sure that we do that as fast as possible? But a mentor is not a title. Mentorship could only be earned. And that was why it was so powerful. You might have the title of a coach, like you got the position as the head coach, but your kids, your players will decide if you're a mentor. You cannot become a mentor until the mentee invites you into their heart. And it was so powerful when it happened. Any great story, you have the hero of the story, and then who appears in the story? It's the mentor. Like Luke Skywalker had Obi-Wan. Rocky, I love Rocky. Rocky had Mick. Frodo had Gandalf. The Aladdin had the genie, right? Like all these examples of great mentors that connected people to their dreams. And really quickly, I know I'm talking a little bit about this, but it's so – I think it's an important thing that good coaches understand and coaches can do a little bit better at. And there's five characteristics that every mentor had that they possessed. In our research, when we saw an individual command engagement, loyalty, buy-in, respect from players, they had these five characteristics. And it's what allowed them to be a mentor, not just a coach. And those, I call them the five C's of mentorship. And I'll rattle through these really quick, but I think they're critical to understand and to think about. Number one is confidence. Confidence is a mindset. Are you confident in yourself? Are you confident in your coaching abilities? Are you confident in the game? Are you confident that you can get your players to where they want to go? That builds stronger trust. The second C is credibility. What's your background as a coach? What's your history? What's your resume? Where did you play? How long did you play for? You know, how many points did you put up in a seat? Like, I want to know that. If I'm going to call you a mentor, you better have some credibility in what you're mentoring me about. The third C is competence. You might know everything about the game of basketball, but as a coach, as a mentor, can you actually get out on the court and shoot a hoop? Practitioners were always more powerful than theorists. People that knew everything about the game versus people that actually played the game. As a drummer, I want to study with a drummer that's playing, someone that has experience. They've got chops, not just methodology. And the fourth one is candor. They had the ability to create relationships so strong that honesty could exist. I want a mentor with someone who's going to be honest with me, someone who's going to give it to me straight. But they've also made those deposits of trust consistently over a long period of time, which allows them to make some withdrawals. So we could have those candid conversations. And I knew that it was coming from a good place because that then wraps in the last C, which is caring. They had the ability to truly care. You know, yeah, the wins are important, but I care more about you as a young man, or I care more about you as a young woman and who you're going to become after this life of basketball. I care about you. Those five C's, confidence, credibility, competence, candor, and the ability to care. Any great mentor in my life, and I'm sure you both can relate, any great mentor that you have had has possessed those five C's. And it was a gorgeous thing to watch in the lives of other people.
Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season, and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit SnapRaise.com, and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time.
All right, I want to ask you about caring. So if I'm a coach, and I want to make sure that I'm building the kinds of caring relationships that are required in order for me to be a mentoring coach, what are some ways that you found in your research that people are able to build connections with others that enable them to have the types of relationships that we're talking about here?
Yeah, it's a great question. Your team members spell connection, T-I-M-E. Granted, they can't spell that well, but that's how they spell it. Time. And I think as coaches, we're really good at creating the to-do lists like the things that we need to do. And I found that good leaders, good coaches, for the most part, they know what they need to do. Like, you know what you need to do to get points on a board. You know what you need to do to create synergy and a good team that has a good culture. Like, for the most part, you know how to do that. You've got some basic framework. But the great coaches knew what they needed to stop doing. Sometimes we're so busy as coaches and we're trying to boil the ocean. Like some of the great coaches, you know, they're so busy. They're so good at stacking and they're just busy. And then they wonder why they can't connect. Instead of making the to-do list, I recommend to coaches that they create a to-don't list. What are the things that you can stop doing in your coaching that would allow you more time? You know, when a player comes and knocks on your door and says, "Hey, coach, I just got a minute. I want to talk to you about the game." Are you so busy because you got emails, you got scheduling things that you're trying to do, you've got another meeting with another assistant coach, you've got this schedule that you're trying to outline, you've got, you know, whatever it is, right? You're busy. But when you create the to-don't list and you realize, okay, I've got to set some boundaries for myself. Simplicity. I love what Da Vinci said in his quote. He said that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Keep it simple. How do we simplify our life so that we can give our players and the people in our lives more time? And it's not even just in our coaching. It's in our personal lives, right? And what do we do in the morning when we wake up? Do you grab your cell phone and start checking the emails? You know, look on Instagram, start scrolling on Facebook. What's going on LinkedIn? You know, check out ESPN. Or do you turn over to the person next to you and tell them how much you love them? It's that design, right? It's understanding that, you know, marriage is grand. It really is. But divorce is about $100,000. It is, right? And good coaching, it takes effort. It takes effort. But when you don't invest and you don't give time, that's where we run into dysfunctional teams. That's where you run into teams that have zero connection. They have zero buy-in because the coach just doesn't have the time. Simplify your life. Make the to-do list.
Yeah, that's a great point. I love that. I think when you start talking about simplifying and you start talking about taking time out to connect with your players, you can extend that into the business world. You can extend that into your own personal life when you think about your family and what's important to you. Am I, as you said, am I scrolling through my phone or am I sitting and talking to my family, creating those moments that we talked about earlier? And it's easy. Look, sometimes the easier thing to do is to just lose ourselves in a screen. And yet at the same time, we all know that if we're really going to build meaningful connections with our family, our players, our employees, whatever it might be, that we have to put that thing down and we have to start spending time, as you said. I think that's critically important. I think it's a great piece of advice. All right, let's move to principle three. And I'm going to paraphrase this and kind of put it into coach speak. So you can create your dream team by putting the right people in the right positions and then connecting your people with each other so that they are all acting as a cohesive whole. So when I read this and I think about it from a coaching perspective, I think about I have to put the right player in the right role on the team. But that's only half the job in my mind, because I think the next piece of that is I have to make sure that I communicate to each of my players what their role is, why it's their role, and how that role fits into us becoming successful. And if I've built the type of relationship that we talked about in the last principle, then I'm going to get people to buy in because I'm going to be honest with them and they're going to know that I'm telling them the way it is and I'm speaking the truth to them. And that's when you get people to buy in. When you don't communicate, when you put people in the wrong positions for their skill set, and you don't communicate why they're there or why they're playing or why they're not playing, then you get all kinds of problems. So I think communicating, getting people in the right places, and making sure that they understand why they're there, to me, that's what I took away from that principle.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. And I talk about the ABCs, right? You hire for attitude, behavior, and character. And sometimes we get focused on the skills, right? How talented are they? But again, your job is to mentor. And you can't control anybody. Like, it's so funny to me how many coaches try to control people on that team. They try to control a team. And I think the great coaches realize that you're not there to control people. You're there to create an opportunity where they understand how to control themselves. And if you hire and you recruit for attitude, behavior, and character, that makes that job a lot easier. Now, I get it. Some coaches you can actually recruit. Like if you're in the college world, like in high school, it's maybe a little bit difficult. Or whoever tries out and what you got to work with is what you've got to work with. I wrote the book in a business standpoint where they are hiring, firing, recruiting people. And so some of it doesn't, you know, necessarily translate, but again, attitude, behavior, and character does. And good coaches were always recruiting. Always recruiting. And I think it saves people in the business world, and it saves even coaches in the athletic world from sometimes we got to just get a player to fill a slot. Sure, yeah, you'll do. I need an extra player. I need a team. And I think, you know, good coaches are always recruiting. They're always recruiting. Even though they might not have a position available, they're always recruiting. And they've got that book, they've got that log of those players that have the attitude. They have the behavior and they have the character. And ultimately, they will be people that will make a great team.
Absolutely. I think that when I hear you say that, what I think about is, in all honesty, I believe that coaching has shifted in that direction tremendously in the last 10 to 15 years, where it used to be that I think talent trumped all. And that's not to say that you don't need talented players, because you can have players with the best attitude and the best behaviors and all those things. But if they're not talented, you still can't win. So you still need to have talented players. But I do think that there's been a much greater emphasis placed upon some of those intangible things, that not only do we need talent, but we also need players who have those intangibles, because that's how we build the kind of connected team that we're talking about. And those are the people, the players, who are going to buy into what we're trying to do. And we can teach them some of the things that they need to know. We can teach them how to fit into our offensive scheme. We can teach them the defensive principles that are part of our program, but we can't teach them to have a positive attitude. We can obviously work with them and help people improve their attitude, but if we bring in people that are high character into our program, we have a much greater chance for success.
Yeah. And again, on the flip side, right, you bring somebody in that just has tons of talent, but they're not teachable. Like, good luck creating a cohesive team.
That's the old saying of, if he comes and plays for us, or if he plays for our opponent, you know, we'll have to compete against him twice a year. If you bring him into our program, we're going to have to compete against him 365 days a year. You know, and I think it's just it's an interesting way of looking at somebody who may be talented but doesn't fit the culture of your program. And I think coaches, generally speaking, are much better at identifying and looking at those character pieces than they ever have been, just because the coaching world has shifted in the direction that we're talking about here tonight, and the direction that your research shows that it should be going. There's far, I think, less of that old school coach, my way or the highway, than there used to be. Now, that doesn't mean that those coaches don't exist, because there are still a lot of them out there. But we have shifted towards the coach that's trying to do the things that we're talking about here, developing buy-in, becoming a mentor coach, as opposed to just someone who is a straight dictator and just says my way or the highway. So that goes to number four. Becoming a mentor coach creates stronger influence, increased, you have the word profitability. I'm going to use increased wins and loyalty that lasts. So I think one of the misnomers, or one of the things that was a myth early on as things started to shift in the coaching landscape, was that all this sort of, you said soft skills earlier, that all these soft skills were things that, okay, that's great, but that doesn't help me win on the scoreboard. I don't want to do all that stuff because it doesn't help me win. And I think it's been proven over time through research and just through general experiences and anecdotes that doing this coaching where you are a mentor, where you are building relationships with your players, where you are not only focusing on the basketball X's and O's, but you're also building a relationship with your players not only does it provide a better experience for everybody, including the coach themselves, but also it leads to increased wins on the scoreboard. So talk a little bit about that in terms of how being a mentor coach improves your influence, can help you win on the scoreboard, and also creates that loyalty where maybe when players are done with the program, they still come back and they want to be connected to you and be connected to your program. To me, that's so important.
Yeah, it's the difference between a coach wanting to be a hero versus a legend. I love the film Sandlot, the Sandlot cult classic.
That's a good movie.
Yeah, dude, it's great. You got the little punk kids, they're hitting the ball over the field, signed by Babe Ruth. You got the dog, the beast that's going to rip their face off. But then Benny, you remember Benny? Benny in the story?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so yep, Benny has the dream. Who appears to Benny in the dream? You remember?
I'm trying to think. Jason, man, where you at? This is right up your alley.
I was gonna say I think it was Babe Ruth, but I didn't know for sure, so I wasn't gonna jump in. I was letting Mike. I knew Mike didn't know it, but I was gonna let him give his chance there. I was pretty sure it was Babe Ruth. The only thing I was thinking about was the lifeguard scene. That's what I was really thinking about.
I remember the dog more than anything else. That's what I remember.
But there's that significant moment where Benny has the dream and Babe Ruth appears in the dream. And it's like, you know, the Sultan of SWAT, the King of Crash, you know, the Babe. And there's the departing words that Babe Ruth says to Benny. And he says, "Remember, kid, heroes get remembered, but legends never die." And every time, you guys, when I hear that, I think to myself, heroes get remembered, but Mr. Jensen's never die.
Yeah, so true.
And like, here's the thing, like the controller coach, you know, the coach that's fear-based, the coach that's the old command and control style model, they get wins. They do. And they get results. But it does not last. And, you know, you might be a hero, right? Because you got a lot of W's. But you won't be a legend. You won't be the coach that created significance versus success. You know, and it's interesting. If I were to ask, you know, who are the last three NFL MVPs? Most people have no idea who those people are. Or if I were to ask you guys, could you tell me who the last two Academy Award winners were for Best Actor?
That's a definite no.
Yeah, right? Like, no clue. Or who were the last two Miss Americas? Like, but yet, these people have tons of fame, tons of popularity, a lot of money. You would consider them people with a lot of W's in their lives. But nobody knows who they are.
To be fair, I know that Joaquin Phoenix won the last one.
Oh, there you go, dude. You got one.
Good work, Jeff.
Because of the Joker. So I knew he won. I couldn't tell you the one before that, but I can tell you Joaquin Phoenix won the last one. So.
Well, you impressed me, man. You impressed me.
I'm impressed. But watch this. You know, could you tell me the name of the coach who made the biggest difference in your life? You know, what was their name?
Mike Klintzing.
See, look at that. Look at that. Did you hear that, Clint?
Yeah, dude. Right there. You know, Mike, who was yours?
Well, I would go back and honestly, I think my first coach and the person that probably had the biggest influence on me was probably my dad. And then secondly was probably my high school coach. And I'd say those two individuals probably had the biggest influence on me. When I think about things that were said positively to me or things that I took with me, I think there's no doubt that those two individuals did that for me. And I have this same discussion. Both Jason and I are teachers as our day jobs. And I always try to explain to people one of the things about teaching that is such a challenge today is the emphasis on standardized testing. And so many states and politicians want to tie your ability as a teacher to your student's ability to perform on a standardized test. And whenever I get in a discussion with somebody about this, I always say to them, okay, I want you to think back in your life And I want you to tell me, who was your favorite teacher? Who was the teacher that had the biggest impact on you in your life? And so they'll search back in their memory and they'll come up with a name. And I'll say, okay, what subject did that person teach? And whatever, the math, social studies, whatever it is. And then I'll say, well, is the reason why they were the biggest influence on you because you're much better at algebra because you had this person as a teacher? Or did they have the biggest influence on you because they spent 15 minutes after class talking to you when your dog died? Or they put their arm around you after you lost a big game? Or they showed up at your music concert on a Friday night when they could have been at home with their own family? And inevitably, they say the latter. And so I start looking at it and you start saying, well, if that's the kind of person that had an influence on you as a teacher, then why would you say that good teachers only are judged by the performance on a standardized test? Because isn't making that connection and building a relationship with a kid more important? Because those are the people who really are able to have an influence. And I think it goes, the same goes for coaches, the same goes for bosses in a business setting. And to me, when you frame it that way, I just think it becomes so much more clear in people's minds as to why that, again, those soft skills, if you want to call them that, is, you know, are so important.
Yeah. And all my research was based off of the employee's perspective, not the leader's perspective. And again, our goal in coaching is to get to the part about our players so that we can build significant buy-in, loyalty. I don't remember a thing that Mr. Jensen ever taught me. But I'll never forget the drumsticks, because the drumsticks represented a moment that sparked possibility. The drumsticks were the moment that he got to the part about me. And then guess whose test scores improved? Guess who held more still in class? Guess who, when Mr. Jensen said jump, who was the kid that said, how high? I'm in. Because he got to the part about me. Heroes get remembered. Mr. Jensen's never die. And it's not the fame, it's not the popularity, it's not the test scores, it's the advocacy. I think every teacher should be tested on how do kids experience you and how do the kids experience themselves when they're with you. That's something we should add to standardized testing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. All right, you went to number five. You already mentioned it when you said sparking possibilities. So your job as a mentor coach is to spark the possibilities in the people that you lead. And when I read this from a coaching perspective, what I took from that one is my job as a coach is to get people to perform at a higher level than what they think they're capable of or what they could do on their own. And I think that the way you do that is, again, by building that relationship so that when you tell them, hey, we need you to do this, or you can do this, they're going to believe you. And if you don't have that relationship, somebody can tell you that, but it just becomes lip service because you don't have that relationship. And so I think sparking the possibility in a player means I've built the relationship and I can give them the roadmap for the type of player that they can be. And I can spark the possibility in my team as a whole because we've all bought into the vision that I'm trying to get across. So that's what I take away from that one.
Yeah. Remember that again, great mentors have the ability to spark that potential and worth in other people so well to the point that they see it within themselves. How do people experience you? How do they experience themselves when they're with you? Do they like themselves best because they're with you? And again, communicating potential and worth is a beautiful way to do that. You know, in the business world, we talk about if they can't grow in your company, they'll go and grow somewhere else. You know, there's a lot of kids. I remember in high school when I played football and I wrestled. You know, if there was never a chance or an opportunity to actually play, like why should I invest? Why should I, if I'm never going to get on the field? You know, there's no potential. There's no hope. There's no dream there. So spark that possibility. Again, your goal is to create the growth development plan. Where am I growing? What are we doing? What are we trying to achieve for you as an individual? I think sometimes collectively as coaches, we look at the overall goal. Where do I want to take the whole team? And I think there's power in focusing on where do I want to take that kid? Mr. Jensen, he's still alive. I call him Larry now. he's still an integral part of my life. And Larry and I, we went to lunch. This was like 3-4 years ago. And we were talking and I said, Larry, I've got to ask you, man, why me? You know, why was I the kid that got the drumsticks? You taught thousands of kids. Why me? And without hesitation, he looked at me and said, easy, I'll tell you why. Because you were my one. He said, every term, every semester, I chose just one kid. And he said, because I realized I couldn't save them all as a teacher. Like that was one of the first lessons he learned as an educator, that he couldn't save them all, but he could save one. And every morning he woke up as a teacher, he wiggled his toes, he knew he was alive, and he went to work for one kid. And I think there's power in focusing on the individual. Yes, you're supposed to coach the whole team. Yes, I get synergy. Yes, there's a unifying thing and we're supposed to all move as a cohesive whole. But remember, there are individuals in that whole that make the whole a whole. And so create a moment, sit down with the kid, and when's the last time as a coach you took a player aside and you breathed life into the kid. And you told him two things. This is what I see when I look at you. And this is what I see you becoming. I'm telling you, like those little moments spark possibility. And it creates buy-in. Because sometimes I remember as a player, and I wrestled throughout my whole high school and a little bit in college. And, you know, it's easy for a coach to just be focused on the team. But man, when a coach took a moment to focus on me as an individual, that's when I felt seen. That's when I felt heard and I felt understood. And it connected me in a way that, cool, coach knows that I'm on this team. He's not just worried about the W. Like, coach sees me. He actually sees me. And I think for players, that's a valuable thing. So take a minute to see them. Tell them what you see and tell them what you see them becoming. Spark the possibility.
Yeah, I like the idea of praising where they are, but also telling them where they can go. And I think that when I hear that, I also take it as from a coaching perspective that it's not just what you can do on the basketball floor with your basketball skills, but it's also maybe what kind of leader can you be? What kind of teammate can you be? What do we need you to do that in the locker room that can help make our team better? So I think that's something that's important to remember as a coach, that you're not just leading and trying to improve basketball players. You're also trying to improve young men or women as people in addition to having them be basketball players. I think that's just something that's important to make note of. Let's go to number 6. Players work at their best in a safe, encouraging, and calm environment. You can create this environment by keeping things simple. So here's what I take away from that. One is, most people, most players, do not play their best when someone is screaming at them, when they are afraid to make a mistake, when they check into a game and they know if they miss a shot or they turn the ball over or they get beat on defense, that they're coming right back out of the game. It doesn't work for players. It's very, very difficult. And then you mentioned it earlier, talking about keeping things simple. And when you make something overly complex, it makes it really difficult on players. And I think one of the strengths of a really great coach is you can take all that complexity and work on it behind the scenes and study it and know the game inside and out. But then when you step out onto the floor and you have to teach it to your players, you make it simple. Because it doesn't matter what you know as a coach. It only matters what the players are capable of doing. Right, are capable of doing. And so I can have all this great knowledge, but if I can't relay it to my players in such a way that they can execute it, then it's all worthless. And so when I hear that statement, I look at, how do I create that calm environment? Am I under control of my emotions as a coach? And when I am, then that allows me to help my players to play in such a way that they are also in control of their emotions. And I can keep the environment simple by taking the complex and all the work that I do behind the scenes and present it to the players in a simple way that they can execute. So that's what I take away from number six.
Yeah. In our research, we found that when it came to conflict or crucial conversations or stressful work environments or, you know, just, yeah, high stress conversations, great leaders were always the lowest heart rate in the room. And I think that's something, you know, there's some value there. You know, you should always be the lowest heart rate on the court. And I think when a coach gets to that point where, again, the emotion takes over and they're so heated up, they're so fired up, they're so mad, they're so frustrated, like, you lose control. And when you're the lowest heart rate in the room, you're able to make better decisions. You're just able to think better, right? When's the last time you won a conversation and you walked away both people feeling good about what just happened when you were the highest heart rate in the room? You know, it never really happens, right? When you can lower a heart rate, when you can bring somebody down and you're at that level and you're communicating in a way that people feel safe, you're just going to be more effective, period. Be the lowest heart rate in the room.
That's a great way to look at it. It's a great reminder to coaches of your players are going to be a reflection of what you are doing on the sideline. And if you're a maniac and you're running up and down and you're screaming and yelling and you're not in control of your own emotions, it's very difficult for you to expect that your players are going to do the same, especially when they're in a high stress situation like they will be when they're competing in a game in front of people in the stands. Eventually, when we get through COVID, when they're back to being able to play in front of fans and in front of people, it's a high stress environment. And when you as the coach don't handle that in such a way, it makes it very, very difficult. All right, number seven. When you give your players a sense of ownership over their playing career and their role in the team, they feel more invested in developing their skills and in the team's success. So if I'm the coach, this is what I take from this one. If I'm the coach and I just keep telling you, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, and I say, this is the way it is, and you don't have any input, I don't take any input from the players, eventually it doesn't become our team, it becomes the coach's team, and the players almost seem ancillary to the will of the coach. Versus when I'm the coach and I get that input and I ask the players and I talk to them about, hey, here's what we're going to do, here's why we're doing it, what did you see there, what do you think we should do? And that's not to say that you as the coach don't ultimately make decisions about what goes on, but I think especially in today's world with today's players, you have to take input from the players in order to be able to get the best out of them. Because as you said in principle number seven, they feel more invested in developing their skills if they feel like they have some input on what it is that they're actually working on.
Yeah, and they walk away with some life skills that are going to help benefit them outside of the game of basketball.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E. And use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's ARYSE.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
Basketball, even I coached the university drumline at Utah Valley University for 7 years, and I always said this in my coaching. Drumming and drumline, it's kind of a pretty unmarketable skill. Like, it's not going to really do much for you in life. Like, okay, in basketball, yeah, there's the NBA. You know, you could coach eventually. Like, there's some skills there. But for the most part, like, it's even then, it's kind of a fairly unmarketable skill. It's the things that you're learning through the process. It's the life skills. It's, you know, how to make good decisions, how to handle stress, how to build relationships, how to work well with other people. You know, there's all the life lessons that we learn in sports. And again, when you help people to understand and take ownership of that by just simply asking them, giving them a voice, I share in the book about how my dad let me drive home from church for the first time when I was a little kid. And he sat me in the seat and he's like, dude, you want to drive home? I'm like, are you kidding me? And yeah, he still had his hands on the steering wheel. He still was controlling the brakes and the gas pedal. But my dad let me take the wheel. And my whole perspective changed. It gave me a little sense of ownership that allowed me to see things differently. And, you know, there's that age old adage of, you know, if everyone says, if you feed a man a fish, you feed him, you know, for the day. But if you can teach him how to fish, then you feed him for a lifetime. Every time I hear that, I think to myself, who said the guy wanted a fish? Like, who said the guy wanted a fish? And the point is, I think that sometimes as coaches, we come in guns a-blazing and we go, this is what we're going to do. This is the plan. This is the objective. This is the play. And I think the significant coaches and the coaches that create ownership, yeah, they've still got their hands on the wheel. Yeah, they're still controlling the brakes and the gas pedal. But they ask their players. They give their players a voice. You know, is this what you guys really want? You make the call. Again, your job is not to control players. Your job is to create an environment where they can control themselves. So give them a little bit of ownership.
That leads right into number 8. You must let players do their jobs, but check in continually to see how they're doing and to find out their status and what they need. And I think this goes to being a micromanager as a coach. And I think of it in a practice environment where if a coach is blowing the whistle every 2 seconds when they see a mistake or when they see something that they feel should have gone differently, then the players really never learn to figure it out on their own. And ultimately, when you're in a game, you're not coaching robots. You don't have a joystick. You don't have a controller. You don't have a touchscreen where you can move those players around like pieces on a chessboard. It doesn't work that way. Ultimately, basketball is a decision-making sport, and they're going to have to be able to make decisions on their own without your input, because there's so many split-second decisions that are made during a game, it's almost infinite. And I think too often, as you said, coaches get caught up in having control, whereas the best coaches, and we can attest to this by the guests that we've had on the podcast, the best coaches talk about how they became more successful when they let go of more control and turned more of it over to the players. And again, it's not that they just let it go and rolled out the balls. They were overseeing what was going on. They were checking in all the time to make sure that those things were going on. But ultimately, they trusted in their players to make decisions based on the training that they were going through as part of that basketball program. So that's what I take away from number 8.
That's great. I think it's kind of shocking how many coaches aren't coachable. You know, you see it in teaching too, right? There's a lot of teachers that are, you know, they're the most unteachable people on the planet, but they teach for a living. And I think, you know, in good coaching, good coaches are open to feedback. And, but unfortunately too, I'll say this as well. Most coaches have no idea that they're doing poorly, because there's no incentive for players to speak their truth to a coach a lot of the time. You know, a coach can sit down and say, you know, what can I do for you guys? You know, how can I be a better coach? And then sometimes there's not a lot of incentive to speak the truth, because you don't want to be the coach, you know, the player that's blacklisted. You don't want to be the dramatic one. You don't want to be the whiner. And who's going to challenge the coach, right? Who's going to, like, you know, sometimes it'll happen, right? But most players are like, it's not worth it. There's no incentive for me to speak the truth. And then then coaches wonder why players are disengaged or why they're constantly having this toe-to-toe conflict on their team. And I think there's power in what we call a status interview. And good managers did this. I think great coaches do this. I came from the medical field. Some of my background is in the OR. And they would always refer to it as the status, like what's the status of the patient. And what they're really asking are, what are the vital signs? So the body temperature, the blood pressure, the heart rate, and the respiratory rate. Those are your 4 vital signs. If one of those is gone or missing, you're dead. And so every team is a living, breathing organism. There are vital signs on every team. And the vitals determine treatment. And so many coaches have no idea what the vitals are of their team. But yet they just they're misdiagnosing their players. They're misdiagnosing the problem, that they're fighting the smoke, not the flame. And so what you do is you check the vitals, you learn how to do that, and then you treat the patient. And then you recheck the vitals, and then you treat the patient again. And you do that until healthy stability is maintained long term. Great coaches know how to do that on their teams as well, and it's done by conducting what we call a status interview. In some way, shape, or form, coaches would ask these three questions of their players. And it always started with vocal praise, like, hey, listen, Jeremy, I want you to know, like, dude, I appreciate you. I appreciate what you're doing on the team, your contribution. You're a leader. You've been stepping in. You've been making plays when I need you. I value you. And I want to know, as your coach, and this is question number one, you know, what can I do to keep you playing? What can I do to keep you on the team? And I know it may sound a little bit weird. And again, I'm speaking a little bit of business language because we don't want employees to leave. When an employee walks out the door, that costs an organization a lot of money. So I want to know, what can I do to keep you here? So in business or in coaching world, think, what can I do to keep you engaged on this team? What can I do to keep you winning? And then question number two is, what's getting in the way of your success? You know, is it Johnny, number 12, that's just the ball hog and is not what's getting in the way of you being successful and this team being successful? And then number three is, what can I do as your coach to help you get there? Those three questions. Every great athlete deserves to be asked those three questions by their coach. It will help you understand the vitals. It will get you a status into what they need so that you can treat your team better.
That reminds me of something that I often think about when I'm running my basketball camps, which are primarily for kids who are in elementary school, or when I coached my kids when they were younger. I always said that one of the things that I tried to judge my success on was how many kids who played on a team that I coached came back to play basketball again the following season. And if most of those kids came back, I'm guessing they came back because they had a positive experience. And so that's one of the things that I really try to make sure that we do when we run basketball camps or when I'm coaching a team, is make sure that the experience of being a part of a camp or a team that I'm in charge of is going to be one that the kids are going to remember. It's going to be one that is going to be positive, and it's going to be one that makes them want to do more of it, not less. And too often, we end up in situations where players want to play, and sometimes they just have to put up with the environment because they want to play basketball. And I think that's the wrong setup. I think we want to have an environment where there are high standards and players want to be a part of it, because those high standards create an environment that everybody wants to be a part of. All right, number nine, hard times reveal true character. How you respond is what people will remember most. And this goes to something that you said a little bit earlier about whether coaches are coachable and whether teachers are teachable. And you just think about the old saying of, people don't hear what you say because they're so busy watching what you do. And I think that when you're a coach, you have to be able to react to situations where there's adversity. You have to be able to handle those in such a way that you are modeling for your players how they should handle and respond in those same types of environments. So if you have a situation where a call goes against you and you as the coach fly off the handle and you're screaming and yelling and you're getting teed up, you can tell your players all you want, hey, when something goes against us, we're going to keep our focus and we're going to do the things that we're supposed to do. But when you don't do that, it makes it very, very difficult for your players to live up to a standard that you're not living up to yourself. And so I think that you have to make sure, again, whether you're a coach, whether you're a parent, whether you're a business leader, whatever it might be, that when things get difficult, that's when we really find out what you're all about. It's easy to say these things when things are going well. Everybody can do that. And that's one of the things that I'm sure a lot of parents try to get across to their kids. Like, look, you know, when things are going your way and you get what you want, you know, you're really agreeable. But then when something doesn't go your way, suddenly you're not quite as agreeable and you're not quite the same high character kid that I thought you were in that other moment when things were going your way. And so it's really, really important for coaches, I think, to model that. So that's what I take away from number nine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're spot on, because here's the thing too, is hard times, difficult times always pass. Like, look at the most difficult thing you've ever gone through in your life. Eventually it got better. Eventually you found your smile. And when that relates to coaching, when in those difficult decisions, those stressful moments, your people, your team will remember how you treated them during that difficult time. And when things get better, they remember. And like, we're talking about COVID-19 right now, and there's a lot of managers, there's a lot of bosses that treated their people based off of the situation and treated them, they snapped at people. And they ruined and lost a lot of trust. And when we get out of this, people will remember how you treated them. So again, that's why be the lowest heart rate in the room, because eventually it's going to get better and they'll remember how you treated them.
Agreed. Number 10, coaches always need coaching. And I think this is something that it is very, very easy as a coach, even as a teacher, as a business leader, to get swallowed up by the loneliness of that job, because you get so caught up in what it is that you're doing and you're kind of on this island and there isn't necessarily someone to talk to. If you're a head coach, yeah, you can talk to your assistant coaches, but there's not somebody outside who's not invested in it that you can talk to unless you have a friend in coaching or a mentor coach or somebody that maybe when you were a young assistant coach that was your head coach that's now retired that you can call up and talk to and say, hey, here's the situation that I'm going through. Am I looking at this in the right way? And that's what I think about when I think about that particular principle of coaches always need coaching. So tell me how that applies to, in your mind, how that applies to coaching.
Yeah, and great mentors are always being mentored. You know, Jim Rohn, right? Classic Jim Rohn. You become the average of the five people that you associate with most. I have no idea if that's ever been proven, but I believe it. If you put a hard-to-catch horse in a field with an easy-to-catch horse, you usually end up with two hard-to-catch horses. And I've seen it, and you guys have seen it. If you're both teachers, you know this in education. A bright, young, passionate, fired-up teacher comes out of student teaching, and they come into their first teaching job. And week one, they go into the faculty room, and there's the old timers, all the calloused, burnt out teachers. And all of a sudden, that, you know, they look at the fresh new teacher and they go, "Why are you here?" Like, "Oh, you why? I mean, brace yourself." Or they start talking about the administration. The teachers that always see the problems, and I have seen the light and the passion be sucked out of a teacher because of who they were associating with, who they're hanging with. You should do whatever it takes to associate with extraordinary people. If there are coaches that are living and breathing and creating teams that you want to emulate, do whatever it takes to associate with those people. My dad was my wrestling coach growing up, and my dad was a state champion, great wrestler, and I grew up at Wasatch High School. And Wasatch High School is a very famous wrestling school. Kel Sanderson graduated from that school. He's a gold medal Olympic champion wrestler. The dude's like lost maybe like 10 matches his whole life. He's the coach at Penn State. And every Friday night, my dad would drag my butt to the varsity wrestling matches to watch Kel Sanderson throw guys around the mat like rag dolls. And as a young kid, I remember giving my dad some grief and being like, "Dude, Dad, it's Friday night. Like, that's date night. Like, that's my time to go hang out with friends. I don't have school the next day." And I remember my dad got a little short with me and he said, "Listen," he said, "Clint, do you want to be a great wrestler?" It's a very serious question. Do you want to be a great wrestler? And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Then kid, you got to hang out by the mat. You got to hang out by the mat." Same thing with basketball. You want to be a great basketball player? You got to hang out by the hoop. You want to be a great coach? Where are the great coaches hanging out? Like, dude, and that's why I applaud you both for this podcast. Like, stuff like this and good coaches that are investing in learning about what other good coaches are doing. That's how we emulate it. Again, any great mentor, a good mentor manager, a good mentor coach, they were always being mentored. They were hanging out by the mat. And it made such a difference.
Agreed. All right. Principle number 11, our last one. Your player's job is one part of a larger life, and that life requires passion, purpose, and the ability to provide. And what I take from this one is I have a coach that is a friend of ours here on the podcast named Greg White, who is a high school coach in Arkansas. And Greg wrote a blog post back in the fall about taking days off during the season. And he said that his thought process on taking days off had changed since he started as a coach. And he used to be the coach who said, no days off. We're practicing every day. We need to be in the gym every day. The off season, my players need to be in the gym every single day. And he came to realize that there was other things that were important in his players' lives that needed to be taken care of. That basketball was, granted, in a lot of cases, an important part of his players' lives, but that there were other things that they cared about and that mattered. And then take it one step further, sometimes just getting the mental rest was important, and being able to recognize that taking a day off didn't make you a failure, didn't make you a slacker, didn't mean that you didn't care. And so he just changed his approach because, again, he recognized that his player was not just the basketball player that he saw for an hour and a half every afternoon at practice, but there was 22 other hours in the day where that player was somebody's son, somebody's brother, somebody's student, somebody's friend, whatever. And being able to recognize that whole person, and it goes back to the theme that runs through the entire book and through our entire conversation, which is if you build relationships and you get to know your players, you find out more about what makes them tick off the floor, and then you can better inspire them to become their best when they're on the floor. So just talk a little bit about that final principle.
Yeah, man, that's the beauty of coaching. Like, again, I get the win is cool. And the success is cool. But the significance, man, I think at the end of your career, like, I don't know. I think every coach is going to be surrounded by two things. Either you'll be surrounded by all the woulda, shoulda, couldas, or you'll be surrounded by the do it, did it, done it's. And, you know, I, as a coach and as someone who's studied coaches and mentors and good mentoring and what that looks like, man, they take pride in the relationships that they have. They take pride in doing something bigger than themselves in the lives of the young men and the young women that call them coach. And you get to be the mentor in that story that allows them to write a better story. Great coaches are not, they're great storytellers, but not in the stories that they tell. Great coaches are good storytellers in the stories that they inspire other people to write themselves. And I've always told any coach, any manager, people that we work with, executives, people we train, that the coolest part about your job is that it matters. The hardest part about your job is that it matters every day. And that includes the off days. That includes the days that, you know, You keep it simple, right? You do the to-don't list and you take the time off. It also includes the days that you're on and you're out there and you're in that moment and it's the championship game and the choices you choose or choose not to make in those moments, they matter in the lives of your players. And there's power in consistency. And I think some consistent efforts done over a long period of time is really what makes this possible. Because we've talked about a lot of things in this, you know, hour and 18 minutes that we've been talking. You know, it's a lot of stuff. But I would challenge, you know, the coach to, you know, pick one thing. What's one thing that, you know, maybe it's a status interview. Maybe I need to, you know, spark a little possibility with my kids. Maybe I need to, I got to get out of the controlling manager and I got to move into that mentor slot. What is it? You know, what is one thing that you can choose that over time, you know, little by little makes a lot? And I know a lot of coaches right now, they feel like they're on an episode of Survivor. You know, just saying like, vote me off. Like, I'm just done. But I want all coaches to hear this and know that your efforts, as small as they may seem, you know, they might just seem like they're a drop in the bucket, but at least it's a drop in the bucket. And over time, your efforts, little by little, it makes a little, a lot. And that's the privilege you have. Every day, you know, you've been given two things on this podcast, the opportunity to listen to this, and then second, the opportunity to choose what you're going to do with it. And I hope people will choose to be a Mr. Jensen. You know, choose to be that significant mentor in the lives of others where they say, I like myself best because of you. And that's why we coach. That's what it's all about. And I think there's no greater calling.
Clint, that's great stuff. And I love that you ended with the little by little quote, because that was actually how I wanted to end the episode, because that was a quote that really jumped out at me. And when I think about just the opportunity that a basketball player has, between most basketball players right now, their seasons are going to be coming to an end shortly, whether you play middle school basketball, whether you played high school basketball, eventually here as you play college basketball, you're going to have 4, 5, 6, 7 months, 8 months between now and your next season. And if you do a little every single day, how much better can you be 8 months from now? And the same thing applies for coaches. If I want to be a better coach when my season rolls around next year, what am I going to do in order to make that happen? How can I improve my craft? What can I go out and read? Who can I learn from? What can I watch? What can I study to make myself better? What books can I read? And I may not be able to see that improvement today. I may not be able to see that improvement a week from now, but I guarantee if you do something every single day, whether you're a coach or you're a player, or you're just a human being, to make yourself better 8 months from now, or better yet, 8 years from now, just imagine how much better you can be, and then consequently how much better your life can be. So Clint, before we get out of here, I want to give you a chance to wrap up with anything else that we may have missed in our discussion of the book. Share with people where they can buy it, where they can find out more about you. Send them to your social media, whatever you want to do to be able to connect with people. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you to you both. I appreciate the opportunity. It means a lot to bring somebody that's not a basketball coach into your community and have the opportunity to serve the listeners. And that means a lot. They can find out more about the book. You can get it on Amazon. It's available for pre-order right now. Again, the title is I Love It Here: How Great Leaders Create Organizations Their People Never Want to Leave. And hit me up on social media. I'm on all of the social media platforms. Happy to connect. And then you can find out more on the website at clintpulver.com.
Clint, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule, for sharing your book with us. As I told you when we talked before the podcast, I really enjoyed going through and reading the book. And I just thought there was so much that, although the book is directed at business leaders, I think that any coach who reads it is going to do the same thing I did, which is you're going to take away and be able to apply those principles that we talked about tonight during the podcast. You're going to be able to apply them to your coaching. So I would highly recommend go out and pick up a copy of Clint's book, I Love It Here, and read it and use it as a way to self-reflect and to grow little by little, as we talked about here on the pod tonight. And Clint, once again, I just want to say thanks to you for jumping on with us. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.